the agenda for today, and there's a single item on the agenda today. It is House File 896. And we do not have a quorum, so I'm not going to officially move House File 896, but just so members know, the plan is to hear this bill today and hopefully by 10 o'clock at the latest be ready to vote on this piece of legislation. So in order to make sure we can get through the time and the questions necessary, I'm going to ask that the department come forward and present the bill to the committee. So I think we're going to start with Mr. Melcher. Mr. Melcher, welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Tom Melcher. I'm the Program Finance Director at the Department of Education. I believe you have in front of you a copy of the bill as well as the department's summary of the bill and the House research summary of the bill. Starting with Article 1, and Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure if it's your preference to walk through the bill language or walk through the summary. I could do it either way.
Mr. Melcher, I think what I'd like is if we walk through the summary, and members, if you follow along on the bill, we'll have the bill in front of us if there are more technical questions for you to follow along with. But Mr. Melcher, I think the summary would be sufficient.
Okay. I'll be operating off of the House Research Summary. It's a section-by-section one. I think that might be a little easier for members if they want to follow along with the bill. The first section of the bill is clarifying the amount of money that must be reserved by a resident school district for students who are attending Area Learning Center programs. Currently, the language for the Area Learning Center programs does not specify whether limited English proficiency revenue must be allocated to the Area Learning Center. The department's understanding from the legislation that occurred when the LEP funding was moved into the basic skills category was that the intent was to have that money follow the student to the Area Learning Center. However, the language was not cross-referenced in the Area Learning Center statute. And the department recommendation is to clarify the statute to specifically include the LEP as well as the compensatory portion of the revenue in that allocation language. The next section, section two, is a clarification or an updating of a manual for activity fund accounting to update the terminology to current terminology. Section 3 deals with taconite revenue, and it specifies that the full amount of the taconite revenue for a school district that they receive in the fiscal year is recognized in the fiscal year in which the February payment falls. There was a change in the timing of payments for taconite school districts back in 2003, which allowed the taconite companies to spread the payments over two payments, one in February and one in August, and there's some clarification needed with regard to that August payment. The intent was that that would stay revenue in the fiscal year that it always had been, which was in the fiscal year ending June 30th, and it's kind of a final payment that's made in August of the following fiscal year. This clarifies that past practice that is in fact recognized as revenue during that fiscal year. The next section, section 4, clarifies the accounts necessary to identify revenue at each site. Currently, there's language that requires school districts to allocate revenue by or expenditures by building. And it specifies that certain categories of expenditures, such as capital expenditures and transportation expenditures, for purposes of department reporting on the department report card and on the department website, are to be spread on an even per pupil basis across all buildings. This language would change that to allow school districts the option that if they are in fact accounting for those expenditures at the building level, that the department in its reports would reflect the way that the district has identified those expenditures by building. So it would reflect the actual reporting by the districts.
Members, at this time we do have a quorum, so I'm going to call the meeting to order, and I am going to move that House File 896 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Governmental Operations. Members, at this time I'm also going to move an amendment, an author's amendment, to get it in the shape the author would like. Members, I move to delete in Article 2, and if you're following along in the summary, I move, if this is on the fourth page of the House summary, to delete Article 2, Sections 15 and 17. Members, Section 15 talks about charter school students' participation in district school athletic programs. It's an idea that is very worthy of discussion here within this committee. This article is being jacketed as a separate bill by Representative Quinzing, and the plan is to hear this bill next Thursday. And Article 17 creates up to five new nonprofit entities whose single purpose is to build the expertise and to sponsor charter schools. Again, an issue that is very valid and worthy of discussion here within the committee, right? And another article that will be jacketed, and I believe has been jacketed, and will be introduced by Representative Dean, and will be heard in this committee on Tuesday of next week. Representative Dorn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Our staff has just pointed out that perhaps the amendment should include Section 14, where there is a reference to the language in Section 15, and I hadn't caught that myself, but think Lisa Larson is clear that that's a piece of what is going on in 15, so I'm trying to track that down. It's something we should...
Thank you, Representative Dorn, and I did look through that, and I'll take advice from Ms. Larson. But Ms. Larson, my question on that section, as I looked through that section and looked at the section in law that it references, I still thought that that was an appropriate piece to have discussed, wasn't solely dependent upon the new language in Article 15, and also created a means by which district schools could indeed charge fees for transportation to the charter school students for those that they have entered into voluntary agreements. And if I'm mistaken, then I will amend my motion. Ms. Larson?
Mr. Chairman, members, my recollection about this particular provision is that it was part of Representative Klinzing's bill last year, and it specifically talks about the substantive changes in Section 15 that you're proposing to have introduced as a separate bill. The language currently... does not address the substantive changes proposed in Section 14, which also appear in Section 15.
Okay, Ms. Larson, members, I stand corrected, and I will amend my motion that to include Article 2, Section 14. So at this point, members, is a motion before the committee to delete Article 2, Sections 14, 15, and 17. Are there any questions? Seeing none, we're prepared to vote. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, my question goes back to the presentation in Section 1. And my question is the expenditure by building. And I think we had a discussion about this a year or two ago. But how would a school district then handle the TOSAs or what I call teachers on special assignment, or TOSAs kind of informal term, that would be providing services outside that building site but assigned to that building site. For example, I think the one I used a couple of years ago, you might have some staff that are assigned to local parochial schools, but they're on the roster, if you will, of the neighborhood public school, and you know how they have to have those lines drawn and that kind of thing. So if you had some staff that were providing services off that site and the students are technically not enrolled there, how would they be calculated in this building reporting?
Mr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Carlson, that's not part of this amendment. It would be handled under the current language in the law. But if a person is housed at one site but they're actually providing services at another site, the school district could identify the other site that they're providing the services at as the site where the expenditures were identified in their UFARS reporting, and then the department expenditure reports would pick up those expenditures at the site that the district is reporting them. So if a teacher is housed at one site, but let's say providing services for Title I programs in non-public schools, for example, those could be identified at those non-public school sites or in a district-wide code for the district, so they would not have to be charged to that particular site. Otherwise, it would distort the reported expenditures per student at that site.
Mr. Chairman, that's what I wanted to make sure that we weren't distorting them, that they were accurate relative to the services actually provided at that site. So thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Heidgerken.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I still have a little confusion there. So we're getting away from reporting. It's no longer, like, for example, compensatory. There's some numbers that can be skewed by site-based and not student-based, enrollment-based. Are we making any changes? I know we have a problem with compensatory because of that.
Mr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Heidgerten, what this amendment does in Article 1, Section 4 is to provide some flexibility to the school district in the way that they report the expenditures for transportation and capital outlay. Currently, under the law, those expenditures are just divided by the number of students in the district, and when we issue the report cards next summer, without a change in law, we would show the same transportation cost per pupil at every site in the district. We would show the same cost for capital outlay at every site in the district. And when the language was written last year, we did that in order to try to save the district some work in terms of their accounting, because a lot of districts just account for transportation on a district-wide basis or capital outlay. But some districts came forward last year as part of our Financial Accounting Advisory Committee and said that they do a lot of work to actually identify those costs by site. And in some cases, there are higher costs for capital outlay in one building than there are in another. And some of those districts felt that their hard work in identifying what those actual costs were would be lost if we simply took the dollars and divided it by student, and it might undermine their credibility if the district is saying, here's what the cost is, and the department overrides that and says, no, it's a flat amount per student. So what we're trying to do here is allow a little bit of flexibility where in the area of transportation and capital outlay, if a district is identifying that on a district-wide basis, then the department will simply allocate the cost on a per pupil basis to all sites. But if they have gone the extra mile and identified those costs on a building-by-building basis, then the report cards would show the actual cost by building.
Any further questions? Members, I've been informed by staff that based on the previous amendment, we now have another section of the bill that is not necessary, right? And that is Article 2, Section 19. And this section, again, is tied into the participation of charter school students in co-curricular activities. Again, this is an issue that will be heard, but for now, Article 19 in the bill is not necessary, so I would I'm sorry, Article 2, Section 19. I'll get that right. Better for the tape. I would move that Article 2, Section 19 be stricken. Are there any questions? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. On to Article 1, Section 5. Mr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and members, Article 1, Section 5, 6, 7, and 8 are all technical amendments that are updating the terminology used for school district statutory operating debt. Years ago, the state used to calculate statutory operating debt based on the undesignated operating fund balances, and several years ago that was changed to the unreserved general fund balance. But the terminology wasn't changed consistently throughout the statute. This is just updating that terminology to consistently use the term unreserved general fund balance. Article 1, Section 9 is updating the or clarifying the language for the contract alternatives program to clarify that the basic skills revenue is generated by students in the program is allocated to the program. This language currently does identify all elements, both the LEP portion and the compensatory portion, as going to the contract alternative school, but the language is a little bit unclear, and this clarifies that that language. There's also a technical amendment in here that clarifies that for these students that the compensatory revenue, which is calculated based on the October 1st free and reduced lunch count, is not prorated based on the number of days that a student is at the contract alternative school. It's calculated once for the year, and if they're there on that date, that school gets it. If they're somewhere else on that date, the other school gets it. Article 1, Section 10 is also a similar clarification for another section of law dealing with the contract alternative schools. Again, it's clarifying that the basic skills revenue follows the students of those schools. And this also clarifies that where we have a contract alternative school that is also a care and treatment facility, that the revenue calculations are done based on the contract alternative school law. And that's the way that they have been done in the past. There was a bit of a controversy between the department and the Minneapolis School District this past year where some people in the department felt that these sites that are qualifying under the care and treatment law ought to be funded under care and treatment rather than contract alternative law, which has been the past practice. And the law was really unclear, and after further review of this, the department agreed with the Minneapolis School District that it was appropriate to keep the funding where it is currently, which is under the contract alternative law. And the language on page 7, lines 31 to 33, is simply clarifying that current situation.
Representative Carlson.
Chairman, just a question. There's been a lot of discussion recently about the aid reduction for alternative programs. You know, at one time it was 2 and then 1.5, and we're way down to 1 now, I think, or whatever that number is, 1.2. Okay. Do contract schools qualify for that aid as well? That's essentially my
Mr. Chairman and Representative Carlson, yes, they do. They qualify for the extended time, the extra 0.2 pupil unit. And by this clarification keeps them in that. If they were care and treatment, they would not qualify for that.
Thank you.
Mr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and members, Section 7 is another of the technical changes that's updating the accounting language for statutory operating debt to use the terminology unreserved general fund rather than undesignated or unappropriated operating fund balance. This reflects the current practice and the current calculations for the statutory operating debt. Section 12 of the bill is providing a definition of the project-based average daily membership. We have a number of charter schools in the state that that operates a project-based program where the students may be doing something to an independent study type program. And up to this point in time, the law has not been clear as to how the average daily membership is calculated for these students. This provides some clarification to the law that would essentially require the school to register as a project-based school, specify that there be a minimum teacher contact time of 1 hour per week per credit, that there be a record system maintained to show when the students are generating credits, and then the calculation of average daily membership would be similar to the way it works for independent study in area learning centers, where the seat-based time the student has in the school is generates ADM based on the number of hours of seat time, but the project-based time is based on the number of credits that the student is earning, and those may be generated largely based on things the student is doing outside of the regular classroom, outside of the regular school day. And we did work with the charter schools in developing this language. It's intended to enable those programs to continue with a comparable level of funding to what they've had in the past, but it clarifies in law how the average daily membership is calculated. Section 13 of the bill deals with taconite adjustments again, and this is language that clarifies the calculation of tax levies for the taconite school districts. Again, there was a change made in the timing of the payments to the taconite districts. There was some concern last year that that would affect the tax levies for schools, although the intent clearly was not to adjust the tax burdens on those schools. The governor intervened in this last year and directed the department to interpret the law to avoid creating a one-time property tax increase in the taconite districts. And this language is basically to follow up on that and to make the language in the law consistent with the intent when the adjustment was made in the timing of the taconite payments, and under the governor's directive that the property taxes would essentially remain smooth in those districts and not create a one-time spike followed by a one-time decrease in the tax levies. Section 14 of the bill is changing the date by which school districts are required to notify the Commissioner of Education of their property tax, certified property tax levies, from January 15th to January 7th. Currently, the school districts are required to submit their property tax information to the counties by late December. So this is not going to create any additional burden on the districts. It just simply means they have to drop a copy in the mail of what they're already sending to the counties before January 7th. And this will ensure that the department has the levy information in time to do the February budget forecast, which in some cases the January 15th date has created some problems for the department in that regard. Section 15 of the bill is another piece of this taconite language update that I just referred to a moment ago. Section 16 of the bill is adding a cross-reference in the excess tax increment calculations. Currently, we have two different mechanisms for the transfer of excess tax increments. One of them kicks in when there's an increase in the property tax rate for the school districts. The other kicks in primarily when the tax increment district is eliminated in their excess funds. The more commonly used provision is one that has a $25,000 threshold before we start adjusting the school district state aids and levies. There's another one that is being adjusted a little later in this section that is rarely used statewide. Last year we had a total of $3,000 involved with that piece. But it's a complicating factor in the law that requires two different kinds of mechanisms to be out there. What the department is recommending is that in all cases we use the kind of the simpler formula, where if the amount of the excess tax increment is less than $25,000, that there's not an aid adjustment and a levy adjustment that would need to be calculated. Section 17 is repealing obsolete language dealing with census. and correcting cross-references to census that is used for community education programs. Section 18 is correcting cross-references. Section 19 is the second piece that I was just referring to, dealing with the excess tax increment, which is excluding school districts from this piece that is nearly never used and allows us to have all of those adjustments be made consistently using the simpler formula that does not involve the aid adjustments and levy adjustments unless the amount changing hands is more than $25,000. And Section 20 is a repealer, which repeals obsolete statutes, including a levy for statutory operating debt that no longer applies to any school districts, and a provision dealing with statutory operating debt going back to 1977 that also no longer applies to any school districts. Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Melcher. At this time, I'd ask if there's anyone in the audience who would like to speak to Article 1 of the bill. Please come forward at this time. Seeing a number of young men and women coming. I don't think they're coming to the table, though. Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make an editorial comment. If you look on page 15, lines 27 to 33, if anyone thinks that the metric system, the decimal system is archaic, you don't need, or is a new thing and fractions are archaic, just read those lines and have a discussion of what a fraction really does in the real world. It's applied mathematics. Thought I'd point that out.
Thank you. Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question on Section 12 of that. The project-based average daily membership, I know there was some discussion about this in the past with my alternative school, it's in my district, the co-op, about using both the project-based and the seat time method at the same time. Mm-hmm. And somehow it allowed them to put kids on a faster track so that they could get funding for classes that they were having in school, and then they could also be working on projects outside of class time. Is that something they can still do, so they could actually qualify for funding on both sides, the project-based and the seat time-based?
Mr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, yes, this would allow let's say there's a student that's taking three classes seat-based and two classes on a project-based. They could do that. You couldn't mix and match within the same course. You're either going to get your funding for that based on earning credit under a project-based system, or you're going to get it based on a seat-based class. But it will allow the flexibility for a student to have some classes on a project-based and some classes on a seat-based approach.
Okay, a follow-up.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could that then mean that in reality there could be more than a... one student could qualify for more than one student on the reimbursement schedule. If they were on any given day, if they were taking both classes and working on project-based things at the same time?
Mr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, on line 26, page 8, this does limit the average daily membership for these types of programs to one ADM per year per student. Currently, the authority to have more than one ADM for a student is limited to the Area Learning Center type programs that would be under the Learning Year program. So if you're looking at an alternative school, an Area Learning Center type program, they can still do this. And in fact, those programs already have a procedure that's similar to this. It's called independent study, where they do have that kind of operation. But but for this this particular statute, currently those programs, the schools that have this type of program, are not currently eligible to receive more than one ADM. They're not part of the learning year program, and this keeps that status quo the way it is.
Representative Eastland, I think this goes to the question that Representative Carlson was asking, or actually the point he was bringing up is that at one time we allowed students to generate up to 2.0 ADMs, and then that's where that comes in, that mix and match. It's now down to a maximum of 1.2 in state law. This section doesn't change that. Right? This section just looks at how we can calculate up to the 1.0, and then the 0.2 is in a different section law. Am I correct, Mr. Melcher?
Yes.
Right.
So, Mr. Chair, could I have one more
question? Representative Eastland.
So, if there's an alternative learning cooperative, what you're saying, then they could generate actually up to 1.2? Is that...
Mr. Melcher.
Chairman, yes. The alternative learning centers are under what's called the learning year statute.
Okay.
And that statute allows the additional 0.2 ADM to be generated through the extended time program. And there's a minimal requirement that they have to have 1,020 hours to get the first one ADM, and then the additional hours on top of that would generate up to 0.2. But that's limited to those area learning center type programs and some other alternative programs. There's also called targeted services programs that fit into that as well. But they require a separate approval under a different statute.
Representative Eastland.
So if a alternative program is just offered within a building as part of the district's offering, then they would be limited to the one ADM. Per student.
Mr. Melcher.
That's correct.
Okay.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Melcher, is the change, and I'm also following up on this project-based mm-hmm. one, and it says it's 1 hour per week of teacher contact time. Is that a change? Is that new, or is that what's currently been in place?
Mr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Peterson, currently there is no statute that speaks to this. The students have been reported by the schools that have project-based learning as if the students were seat-based the entire time. And they have been generating one ADM regardless of the amount of actual teacher contact time. This came up in an audit that the department did of the New Country School. And the department auditors said essentially they were unable to make any sort of audit findings because the law was not clear in terms of how the ADM should be calculated in this case. And what this section does basically is comes back and says we will then clarify what the requirements will be. I believe that in most cases that those students were providing a minimum teacher contact of that amount. Mr. Brown is here as well. He may have more details on the exact operation of those programs currently. But this would put that requirement specifically in law so that if programs were audited, there was a standard there. Currently, it's just unclear, and there wasn't a sufficient basis for our department auditors to make any judgment.
Okay. Seeing no further questions, thank you. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Biskins. Mr. Melcher, back to Representative Eastland's concern or questions. Is it possible, because I've taught in the alternative programs, that perhaps in some project-based, the same course is the confusing piece, that the student does the seat time at the center and then goes home and works on the project, but it's for the same course. That's a violation, correct, of getting the additional, being able to count for more than one?
Mr. Chairman and
Mr. Melcher.
Representative Erickson, under this structure, that would be typically how these project-based programs would work. They would be required to have at least 1 hour with the teacher each week for that class. And they would be doing their project-based things, kind of like an independent study,
right.
But they would have this periodic check-in at least once a week with the teacher,
right.
So that they would be on task in terms of maintaining their project. Now, the actual amount of average daily membership that they would be generating for that course would be based on the credit that they're earning for that course. So in that particular course, we're not counting the seat time as something extra. We're counting, basically, they get average daily membership. Let's say it was a year-long course. They get, and it was a six-hour day. They'd be getting 1/6 of an ADM for completing that course. And the completion of that course would include the basically a minimum of 1 hour per week with the teacher, along with the independent study work that they were doing, and then reporting back to the teacher in terms of the the completion of the project. But I think this is a separate piece of legislation from the current law, which already authorizes the 0.2 for extended time, and this would be available to programs that were not extended time programs under the Area Learning Center or other alternative school laws. This is just for regular project-based schools that are providing, typically in this case it's charter schools, but it would not be limited to charters.
Thank you, Mr. Melcher. Members, we're going to move on to Article 2. Mr. Sullivan, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Barry Sullivan with the Office of Government Relations for the Department. The remaining sections of this bill come from various people in our department. Most of the provisions in Article 1, of course, came from Mr. Melcher. So here and there I'm going to ask a few people to come and help describe their proposals, but I'll go through the summary, and if there are detailed questions, we can defer to our experts in the department who give us these proposals. You have two summaries in front of you, and the one from House Research on pages, page 3 is the beginning of Article 2, and the other summary you have is from the department. I had to put this together for the governor's office. It's in a special format. It's more of a topical summary, so I'll give you a choice as to which one you want to use. On page 3 of the department summary and page 3 of House Research summary, the first six sections of Article 2 amend and update the school district curriculum instruction and performance law. This is the old PER law, or planning, evaluating, and reporting law, that some of you may recall from the 80s. Now it's called curriculum instruction and student performance reporting. Requires the districts to do certain reporting to their local public on their curriculum instruction programs. Our staff in the department decided it would be best to update some of this language so that it corresponded with the academic standards changes elsewhere in statute. So most of the six sections you see here is really an update of current law. It doesn't change fundamentally the reporting responsibilities of the school districts. I think probably a couple of policy changes here. It does allow districts to report to their public by electronic means. That's new, and that's something school districts asked us to do. It would also allow, however, people who do want hard copies, paper copies, to access those from the districts at their request. And also, I believe in the reports that the school districts send to us, the reports would include staff development goals, which they also have to do according to another law. So it's aligning current statutes in a better format. This came from Assistant Commissioner. This proposal came from Assistant Commissioner Marianne Nelson's office. So if you had any questions on that, you can take those. If not, I will move on to the next provision. You can stay here for the next few of you. The next provision is Sections 9 and 10, Dangerous Weapons Reporting.
See, Mr. Sullivan, we do have a question. Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and I didn't know how we were moving through here on Article 2. But Mr. Sullivan, on page 17 of the bill, line 3, it mentions best practices as a report. And is that refer to somewhere in state law, or what would best practices entail? I mean, how would that exactly work out for a district? What would they have to report?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would try to answer
that.
Name
for the tape.
I'm Marianne Nelson, Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Ed. That would really be up to the school board, local school board. It's a fairly well-known term. Each district defines, in fact, each building principal often defines the best practices in their own way that they are using in their district. If you were to go to the research, you'd just find hundreds of them. So it's a generic term that's meant to give flexibility to the school district.
Representative Marquardt.
Oh, so there isn't a current reference to law, the best practice. It's going
I am not aware of any, sir, but we can check that out.
One other thing, Mr. Chair. Starting on line 11, page 17, it talks about a plan for improving instruction curriculum and student achievement. And isn't that something that's part of No Child Left Behind? If you don't make AYP for 2 years, you already have to do this. So this is actually kind of requiring school districts to do it even before they may be cited for not reaching adequate yearly progress?
Assistant Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, exactly. The language is meant to align what we currently have in statute with No Child Left Behind. The intent of the PER bill, this used to be known as the PER Planning Evaluation Reporting Bill. Many of us who were in the schools over the years have tried to include student achievement. You'll see that part of this current law does require a district to do a biennial assessment of their student assessment program. So it's really more trying to bring it together in a package that's aligned across all of the features.
Thank you, Mr.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment, Assistant Commissioner. Perhaps in your communication with school districts, you could recommend that they define best practices on the website so that their constituency knows what their definition, whether it's building site or district, what best practices is, because it is a misleading phrase.
Representative Abor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to wait to the end, but since we're dissecting this, I have a question.
Members,
on
Representative Abor, members, I think I'd prefer, as the questions come up,
okay,
we ask him. Representative Abor.
And I'm not sure I'll offer an amendment today, but I do want to comment about on page 16, lines 29 to 32, we're redefining the word curriculum, and I think we're actually softening it quite a bit, and maybe the chair and Representative Dorn would like to look at this a little later, but the term expected on line 31, and we're actually not going to have positive attitudes taught in school anymore, which is, I guess, a choice we can make, but we're having learning experiences that lead to expected knowledge. And that means you don't have to have any outcome. You can expect that they would have if they would. I mean, it's just an interesting little softening of the term that actually used to be lead to knowledge. Now we're leading to what we expect might be knowledge. And it's a nuance that may have something you want to just think about later. That I think is, maybe it's a little gobbly or something, but and maybe there's a reason for that, but I can't think what it might be, except if you want to kind of lower a bar.
Representative Abor, so while one... I would agree with you that it does sound a little gobbly there, but I think the addition of the language at the beginning of that sentence adds more clarity than what was current law. Right? When it says curriculum means written plans, that could be my sub-lessons, I guess, and we don't want to define that as curriculum, so I'm grateful that they tightened up the language at the front end. Right? But the expectations piece, do you want to address that, Assistant Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think you answered it quite well. The expected knowledge is that I don't believe personally in having participated that softens it. I think the curriculum, what we have is a statewide accountability plan. We have student assessment. We have the expectations. But on the attitude part, in the standards, the legislature and the governor signed into law the expectation that we will include knowledge and skills and we will not address attitude. So it was an attempt to align this language with what has already been passed into law and what is reflected in the standards, too.
Thank you, Representative Abor.
I have another question.
Representative Abor.
Is it appropriate to talk about Section 10?
Representative Abor, we'll ask those questions after it's been described.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Mr. Sullivan.
Section 7 through 9, page 3 in the department summary, pages 3 through and 4 in the House research summary, is really updating our current law on dangerous weapons reporting to align with federal reporting requirements as well as our current practices and how we collect these reports. The essence of this would reduce reporting requirements from twice each year to once a year for school districts. Current law requires districts to report dangerous weapons and dismissal incidents to the department. In 2004, we upgraded our electronic system so that districts now send these to us electronically. The proposed changes are really four substantive changes in the law. Reducing the reporting requirements from twice each year to once per year. Requiring districts to use the new electronic reporting system, which they are using now, for both dangerous weapons reporting and dismissal reporting. It would eliminate a requirement that non-public schools must report this information, and it would require submission of certain demographic information, which is necessary to comply with the federal requirements. The demographic information we had been asking for in the report, so this simply is putting in statute what we have been asking for in the reports. Those are the substantive changes in sections 7 through 9 in dangerous weapons reporting. Sections 10 and 12 is the comprehensive scientifically based reading instruction changes. And I'm going to defer to Assistant Commissioner Nelson on this one.
Assistant Commissioner.
The purpose of this is to align the basic description of what is good reading instruction in our schools with the expectations of No Child Left Behind, and also to add what experts in the reading field felt could be improved by adding the continuous integration of assessing and evaluating student progress so that their teachers would be providing appropriate differentiation of instruction and strategies. So what it does is it adds the five reading areas that are generally understood in the literature from the federal government as well as the state, and we think this strengthens it. In working with the Board of Teaching, by the way, from the very start, I believe I can safely say this is supported by the board as well, and we've had reports that this change in the language will actually help staff as they review reading programs, because it just adds another level of clarity to the process. So this will affect the reading preparation of teachers and the continuing education of teachers, and we think it's a good change.
Thank you. Representative Gaffney, was your question to Section 10?
No, I'm sorry, it was to Section 8, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gaffney.
Thank you. I'm just wondering the rationale for deleting the requirement that non-public schools report dangerous weapons experiences.
Mr. Sullivan.
The principal reason, it's my understanding, first of all, they can't use our electronic system to report. You have to be a school district, is my understanding, to get into our department and submit these electronically. Secondly, it's not required, the federal government does not require reporting from non-public schools. And I think, and this is just what I've been told, this is a provision that, frankly, many non-public schools were unaware of that they had to report, and we probably weren't getting many reports from them. The change that you see here is in the bills on page 20, line 22. The reference before was to school, and I think many non-public schools assumed this was, which most of these statutes are, refer only to public schools. So I don't believe we were getting many of these reports in the past anyway. But that's the I think that's the fundamental rationale of staff who put this together.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hadney.
I guess I'm bemused that we're letting the technology drive the information as opposed to the information drive the technology, and that the prime rationale for the department is that because these schools haven't been following the law, instead of asking them to follow the law, we should just change the law. It seems that if we want to ensure student safety, that student safety issue isn't limited to just public school students. It should be limited to kids, and that parents should have access to information about weapons and dangerous weapons incidents in schools in their area.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, as we have become aware of the interpretation, this does apply to non-public schools. We are we can't do it electronically, but we do have a form prepared that we send out to a non-public school to report this. So we are trying to implement the law as we understand it, the current statute, through a paper format.
Okay. Representative Abor.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. On Section 10, and it's which really defines what a reading program is. I'm just reading this. On line 30 on page 21, it talks about, I think it makes the definition more confusing to me as a reader, and I'm not going to move to amend it, but I just, my whole thought is, we're layering these schools down with rules upon rules, definitions that don't really do as much as we think they might, except for somebody who's in a scientific think tank somewhere, wondering how they can succeed, and making them succeed with, you know, modest dollars and more demands. And I, just for instance, and yet we think that they must not be very smart, and that they have really low expectations for their students. On line 30, we're expecting them to achieve, at a minimum, satisfactory progress. Now, I just don't know what school board I've ever met, or any teacher I've ever met, even the the bell curve, even the lowest point of the bell curve, that it was had a goal of less than satisfactory progress, and we all vote for the bill, but I wonder what we're doing in the grand scheme of things. And I think if we took away three quarters of these rules that we're going to pass today in the whole book and said, do your best, that they would do better and they'd have less strength. So that's just, it may have been an editorial, but I was kind of befuddled as I read this, what it actually said to me. And so that's my thought, that maybe the department can comment, and maybe they don't need to, but if they like it better, everybody likes it better, I'm not sure they want to say this is not better, but I'm not sure it makes it any better, Mr. Chair.
Representative Abor, I hope you join me as on my personal goal to reduce from 15 two-inch books called statutes to 14 someday. All right? It's a small goal, but one I think we could work together on. Assistant Commissioner Nelson, if you could more specifically talk to who was involved in this language change. I'm a math guy. Representative Abel is a chiropractor. We read this, and it looks, there's more words, and once to me there's more words, it becomes more confusing and less concise. But could you just tell us who was involved, give us some comfort that people who are knowledgeable in the field actually were at the table writing this language?
Mr. Chair, there were two work groups involved primarily. We have something called a Quality Teaching Network for Reading in the state of Minnesota, which includes several experts from higher ed and practicing teachers in school, as well as our reading specialist at the department. And then the other working group was what I call a work group involving the executive director of the Board of Teaching, our director of academic standards and professional development, and people who implement the evaluation programs of higher ed in all of the content areas. And I might emphasize, this language really is directed to higher ed programs. It's probably language school districts would not necessarily see. And what we tried to do, just to make it succinct, is look at what's currently in law and make sure that when you look at how complicated the system is of who prepares teachers, what that means for schools, that the direction to higher ed be clear. And we looked very carefully at every language change with the experts, and the intent was to actually up the bar. The current definition didn't address student achievement, and so by adding this, the experts felt we would be directing those who prepare teachers to go in our public schools to actually be assessing the degree to which they will be able to improve students' reading. So it was an attempt to, come on, we've got to get organized here and have our kids reading better, and that means our reading prep programs need to be more specific.
Representative Latt. Representative Gaffney.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to join you in your goal of reducing 15 two-inch books to 14. I'd like to move that we delete Section 8 on page 20. The provision that I was questioning earlier about the deletion of the requirement that non-public schools report dangerous weapons incidents. I believe parents of students in these schools and the communities around them have both a right and a need to know if there's dangerous weapons incidents in those schools.
Representative Daphne moves to delete Article 2, Section 8. Are there any questions, comments? Representative Hammer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the question I have is, and I don't know if Deputy Commissioner Nelson could answer this. I can't see you there, but I know you're still there. I see the top. There we go. How much reporting do we have of the non-public schools to the department? What I'm wondering about is, do we have kind of a hodgepodge of some of the things that public schools, private schools also report, and some they don't, or is there generally one way or generally the other? I'm concerned about having a mixture of when they do and when they don't, as opposed to schools report or schools don't. Do you understand my thinking?
The question relates specifically to
Mr. Sullivan.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, I'm wondering, because we're talking about whether or not a non-public school should report this data, and I'm interested in the kind of consistency that we have in asking private schools. You know, do they report sometimes when publics and sometimes not, or do they generally report when publics do and generally don't when publics don't? That's what I'm curious about.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative,
Mr. Sullivan.
It's fair to say that most of, I would hazard to guess, well over 90% of the reports we receive are from public schools only, not from non-public schools. It's seldom that we
get reports, I'm trying to think offhand of one, that directly from a non-public school. Most of the services we provide non-public pupil aides, transportation services that are that do help kids in non-public schools, reports come from the school districts because they are the fiscal agents, they provide the services. Perhaps Mr. Melcher can think of a report coming directly from a non-public school, but offhand I can't name one. I'm not saying there aren't any, but certainly most of the reports are from, directly from public schools. This would be an unusual circumstance.
Mr. Sullivan, I see somebody has joined you at the table. Would you like to speak to this issue? If you would, please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, Representative, my name is Mary Kay Litzow, and I'm from the Minnesota Department of Education, Compliance, and Assistance. And the reason why we deleted the language about non-public schools was we're using the information that's being gathered for both federal and state reports, and there is no requirement for the non-public schools. And because we do not generally collect non-public school information, and we do not have a format to do that besides a paper way, and we have no way to obligate non-public schools to provide that information, we just thought it would be clearer and cleaner to delete the requirement for non-public schools to report.
Mr. Sullivan, I just have a quick question. Forgive my naivete, but is a homeschool considered a school?
Mr. Chairman, I was just going to raise that a homeschool is a non-public school. Yes, so they
If we do not clarify public, then if we were truly ensuring that all schools comply, we would expect to receive reports from every homeschool. And of course, if you're homeschool, you've got the kitchen knives, and it creates a conundrum. I can understand. Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess what I'm getting to here is, are we creating an exception that might create some a possibility? I hadn't thought about the homeschool. I really appreciate Representative or Mr. Chair, you bringing that up. I'm just concerned about unintended consequences of opening this up. You know, I think it's important that we, obviously, we want to know about instances like this that happens, whether it's a public or a private school, and quite frankly, I think we probably would find out about some of these things, or maybe not. There's also data privacy I haven't thought about, but I guess that's true with public. But it just concerns me with Representative Dabney's amendment and what the unintended consequences of that might be. And if we're creating an exception here that causes privates and other schools to have to report when they normally don't report things, I'm just wondering about enforcement and the kind of conundrum we might be creating here.
Representative Heidgerken.
Yes, to that point, and to Representative Dabney's amendment, again, we've got to be careful, and some of the reasons that the private schools have not pushed for the voucher system is because of strings attached. And again, I think when you look at, we give very few public dollars go to the private schools in itself, and they like that idea. They, at least in my area, have not really been very strong for the voucher program because they like their ability to do what they want to do with all these strings attached that the public schools have. Mm-hmm. So again, by making them report, we're creating a problem here, I think. But anyway, just some comments.
Representative Dorn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was kind of looking at it the other way. The question would be, I'll give my assumption of if the report has to be filed by paper and you said there is a form, my assumption was it would be probably a one mark form. They would simply say we did not have any incidents of, you know, I mean, they would be able to report that, or do they only report if there is an incident? They file the report, am I correct?
Ms. Whitson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the report for the non-public school would just be reported if there was a dangerous weapon incident at school. For public schools, okay, currently, they would need to make a report if there's zero, but under the new system that's being implemented as of this school year, if they don't have a dangerous weapon incident report, then no report needs to be made. But, Mr. Chair, could I clarify?
Ms. Whitson.
Is the amendment to delete the entire Section 8 that was before the committee?
Yes, Ms. Whitson, that is correct.
Mm-hmm. That data is required for both federal and state reporting. And so if we did not have the electronic reporting system to collect the data on public schools, we would not be able to meet our federal and state mandates.
Yeah. Thank you for that clarification, Representative Carlson.
Chairman, I understood Mr. Sullivan's comments, or one of the witnesses at any rate. Current law requires them to report. Isn't that what was stated? And you indicated that for some reason they didn't know that they needed to report, but the current law required them to. So actually, this is a major change. I can't comment on why you didn't work with the private schools to see to it that they knew that they were supposed to report, but I would assume that burden should have been on the department to inform them. But this is a major change in current law, then, if they are required to do it now. You know, if the Dabney amendment prevails, we can perhaps look at some other language on the electronic reporting to make sure we meet that requirement. But I think to no longer require what is essentially about the schools provide services for about 10% of the state population. I also picked up on the point that something like 90% of the reports come from the public sector. Well, then that means 10% are coming from the private sector. If that number was at all accurate, so some must be reporting, and they represent about 10% of the school services. So I would expect that only 10% would be in the private sector, if that's their share of the market, so to speak. If they can respond as to what exactly the status of current law is, I would appreciate it.
Representative Carlson, I do believe they talked about what current law is, but we can ask if there's more.
For clarification, Mr. Chairman, that I restated that because I want to know if my interpretation is correct.
It's my understanding, Mr. Chairman and Representative Carlson, it's my understanding that our staff now believes that the law should have been applied to non-public schools. I'm not sure. I think there was confusion in the past, I believe, in terms of since most reports don't come from non-public schools, whether the non-publics were required to do this or not. It is our interpretation, as I understand, that it is a requirement of non-public schools. We have, therefore, communicated that to non-public schools, I believe, in a letter that we sent out, as well as the paper copy that we have developed specifically for non-public schools to comply with current law.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, then as a follow-up, you have, in fact, done that.
Did they
request to be exempted from the law?
Oh, I mean homeschool.
Mr. Sullivan.
Yeah, then accept homeschool.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, I'm unaware of specific requests from them. Perhaps Mary Kay Litzau would know.
Ms. Litzau.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we were in contact with one advisory group or agency representing a non-public schools that became aware of the requirement through Mr. Sullivan's training and then asked for a form. So we provided them with that alternative format that for a small group of the non-public schools. Our concern is simply that we can't obligate them to provide that information. We certainly can, we can amend it to include them again, but it can't be part of the electronic reporting, and it isn't required for any other reports that we are required to submit.
Representative Carlson.
Chairman, you say you can't obligate them if we have a state law that requires a pencil, paper, or electronic. You've obligated them. And by the testimony you just gave, you shared that information that they have to report. Somehow you gave them a pencil paper form, and what you just said, they apparently accepted that. They didn't say to you, as I understand your testimony, that they somehow wanted to be exempted from the law of reporting. Right, reason I'm asking the questions, Mr. Chairman, I, you know, 10% of the students are served in the private sector, and if there are situations where students have been put at risk, I think that parents and the general public should be aware of that. We're talking about you know, weapons in schools, which is a very serious issue.
Representative Kavney, would you like to speak to your amendment?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This has been a good discussion, and narrow is always better. What I would like to do at this point, Mr. Chair, is withdraw that amendment, and then Ms. Larson has language that I think reflects excuse me, the concerns raised about both by the Ms. Witzaw,
is it?
Pardon. Narrowing the amendment, as well as the concerns about exempting homeschools, and it was never the intent to, never my intent to expand this to homeschools. So, if I can withdraw the amendment, and then the chair would recognize Ms. Larson.
Representative Davin moves to withdraw his amendment, and then I believe Representative Davin wishes to amend. Ms. Larson.
Mr. Chairman, members, on page 20 of the bill, House File 896, on page 20, line 22, delete public. On page 20, line 24, after the period, insert for non-public schools, comma, except homeschools, comma. And on page 20, line 24, delete or strike must and insert may. On page 20, line 24, reinstate the stricken word. On page 20, line 25, reinstate the stricken language. On page 20, line 26, reinstate the stricken language and insert, period, the public school reports must be. So that the sentence would then read, for non-public schools except homeschools, the reports may be made on the standardized forms or using the alternative format, period. The public school reports must be submitted using the electronic reporting system.
Thank you. Representative Gaffney, if I may ask you a question. So the intent, as I understand it, still includes the reporting requirement of non-public schools, excluding homeschools, but with the issue of the electronic, it says they can file it by paper, or they must file it by paper. Is that correct? Is that your intention?
Mr. Chair, my understanding of Ms. Larson's language is that they may file either by paper or electronically. But my understanding from the department is that they're not actually able to file electronically.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's correct.
So, I think you've got the intent correctly. It maintains current law so that parents can have the knowledge of dangerous weapons incidents. It actually clarifies current law in terms of homeschooling by carving out space for them to not be held to this requirement, and still facilitates the department's goal of moving the majority, overwhelming majority, it sounds like, of these reports to an electronic format.
Representative Lax.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a drafting question. If it is the intent of the motion here to exempt homeschools from the reporting requirement altogether, as I think gathering is the intent.
And I'll move that to Representative Davin, seeing as he's the author of the amendment, we'll ask what his intention is.
And I will move that to Ms. Larson as the scribe of the amendment.
Ms. Larson.
Mr. Chairman, perhaps Representative Lass is suggesting that on page 2, line 22, after school, we put the exclusion up there, which would address all schools and make clear that non-public schools are not included within the definition of school for purposes of this paragraph.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Larson has been reading my notes over my shoulder.
Representative Davin, would you incorporate that change into your amendment?
Mr. Chair, that was both my intent and my discussion with part of my discussion with Ms. Larson, so yes. Please.
So members, we have the Davin amendment before us. The fundamental issue, Representative Davin, and I'll let you speak to this before we vote, seems to be, should the state be requiring reports of the public school? Current law says it should, right? This change says it should not, and that's the issue before the committee. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, I have a different understanding. My understanding is that current law requires non-public schools, including home schools, to require dangerous weapons incidents to report. Excuse me, thank you, Representative Latz. Somebody come with a gun. Connie, it's Tuesday. It's your turn. The current law requires reports by public, non-public, including home schools, of dangerous weapons incidents in either hard copy or electronic. The intent of my amendment is to exempt home schools from that requirement, continue to allow non-public schools to report by hard copy, and move the public schools to an electronic format.
Any further questions?
Thank you.
Representative Thorne.
It's really not a question. I'm still trying to sort out how we know they weren't reporting if they only had to report an incident. If they had no incidents, then they would not have reported anything, but they would have been in compliance with the law, if I'm thinking this through. Mr. Chair, I think it is good if there is an incident that we know about it and that they report it, but it doesn't seem to be particularly onerous. I would just say, having attended private schools most of my life, that I would expect them to voluntarily report non-incidents, just because I think that's a good message for them. So I would think this is a helpful amendment now.
To the Daphne amendment, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say no.
No.
No. The motion does not prevail.
Division, Mr. Chair.
Division being called. All those in favor, raise your hand. You can put your hands down. Those opposed, raise your hand. On a vote of 10 in favor, 11 opposed, the amendment does not prevail. We are on Article 2, Section 10. Are there any further questions on Article 2, Section 10? Then we will continue on the bill. Mr. Sullivan.
Mr. Chairman, I believe we're on science teacher licensing, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
And Assistant Commissioner Nelson will describe that.
Assistant Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Section 11 is a provision that the department has included to try to respond to the needs of schools. Right now in Minnesota, we have approximately 500 currently teaching science teachers who do not have full science licensure. And as we look not only at the current situation of those teaching on special board permissions, whether they be called a variance or a waiver, the intent is to try to provide access to our currently teaching and fully licensed teachers in one area of science to be able to add another area of science. And the proposal has been developed by our science specialist with the help of his quality teaching network in science. And the proposal is that if there is a currently licensed Minnesota teacher of science in one of the four areas, that if they want to add another licensure area so that they can teach under their license in that second area, they could pass the Praxis 2 content test at the cut level set by the Board of Teaching, and by virtue of passing that, then that would earn them the ability to teach without a waiver or variance in that particular area. The Praxis 2 is a subject assessment and specialty area exam. It is an exam that we use currently in Minnesota licensure under board rules for every content area, and so it is something with which our procedures and teachers are familiar. It's a means by which to give 500 teachers in Minnesota who are currently licensed in at least one science area the option, if they should so choose, to add another science area.
Mr. Sullivan.
Mr. Chairman, the next provision, section 13, page 3 in the department summary, page 4 in the House research summary, is for Mr. Melcher. It would eliminate the superintendent report on pass rates. That's in the SOTA statute 123B.143, and I'll Tom describe that for you.
Mr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman, members, Tom Melcher of the Department of Education. The department is recommending elimination of the superintendent's report on passage rates. Currently, school superintendents are required to report annually to the department an estimate of what they think it would cost to achieve an 80% passage rate on the basic skills test. This report has been on the books since 1998. It has not received a lot of attention in recent years. The school superintendents opposed this. This report, the requirement to do the report, we currently do not receive any sort of documentation of the methodology that different superintendents use. We know that each superintendent is using a different methodology, and so we don't have a consistent, reliable method of receiving this information. Also, that the current standard is that we're looking at the cost to achieve an 80% level on the basic standards test, which isn't reflective of the current academic standards that we have. So we feel that it's an unnecessary reporting burden on the superintendents and are recommending repeal of the report.
Mr. Sullivan.
Mr. Chairman, the remaining provisions in Article 2 came, I believe, from Mr. Brown, Morton Brown of our department, so I'm going to refer to him. And I believe we're moving now, since Sections 14 through 15 and Sections 17 and 19 were removed. We'll start with Section 16 and then skip over the other ones that were removed.
Mr. Brown.
Mr. Chairman, Morgan Brown with the Education Department. Section 16 is a follow-up. As the department was implementing the 2003 online learning law, there was an exchange of letters between the department and the four education committee chairs at that time, former Representative Segrin, Representative Sikora, Senator Stump, and Senator Kelly, clarifying how students that were in so-called hybrid online learning programs, which are those programs where some learning is happening on an online basis and a substantial portion is happening in a brick-and-mortar school facility, were to be funded under that law. And so this legislation was brought forward as a result of those clarification letters both last year and then is being reintroduced in the department bill this year. Then Section 18, which is a request to extend the timetable in the current law for the commissioner to review and approve or deny applications for new charter schools from 60 days to 90 days due to the fairly extensive review process that we do within the department and the increased number of charter school applications we're receiving. This allows the department to have more time to do its due diligence in reviewing those charter school applications.
Seeing no questions, Mr. Sullivan.
Mr. Beck, Tom. Section 20, this is a general education revenue definition for charter schools.
Tom Melcher, Department of Education.
Mr. Melcher.
Section 20 of the bill is a technical amendment clarifying the components of general education revenue that are used to calculate general education revenue for charter schools. They were inadvertently not updated at the time that the general education formula was restructured during the 2003 legislative session. Section 4 is a technical clarification prohibiting a charter school from receiving aid, grants, or revenue that replace levy revenue.
Mr. Sullivan.
Sections 22 through 24 of the bill, I think it's fair to say, are fairly technical amendments. It's updating the Indian Education Act to reflect, primarily to reflect the removal of some obsolete references and a committee that no longer is in existence. It's for Mr. Brown's area, but I believe that's fairly technical amendments.
Mr. Sullivan.
Article 3, Special Programs, Section 1.
Excuse me, Mr. Sullivan. So we're done with Article 2 at this point?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Right. Yeah.
Is there anyone in the audience who would like to speak to Article 2? Mm-hmm. Welcome. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Grace Schwab, and I am Director of Governmental Relations for the Minnesota School Boards Association. We had one question dealing with Article 2, Section 5, page 18, line 31.
State your question, Ms. Schwab.
The question is, how should the public be notified? Usually school districts have publications in the legal newspaper for notification of using this. We need a little bit more language there to tell us how we are supposed to notify the public we're using the electronic means.
Mr. Sullivan, do you want to speak to that?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not positive. Assistant Commissioner Nelson has some ideas for me as to exactly how the notification is to occur. The intent was simply to ease the burden on districts by allowing them to do this electronically, and then if upon request, I thought, hard copies would be made available if people were unable to access it electronically.
Thank you, Mr. Sullivan. Mr. Sullivan, and to Ms. Schwab's question, I empathize as a former school board member, or not school board, city council member. You're always wondering when statute says you have to notify, well, is that by paper? Do I have to call everyone? You know, what the devil does that mean? So having some clarifying language, I think, would be helpful. Ms. Schwab, does your organization at this time, is it prepared to provide clarifying language? And if not, thank you for saying no, all right? Would you work with me so that we can get the clarifying language as we move this bill on to governmental operations?
Well, Mr. Chairman, thank you for a nice way out. We'll be happy to work with the department.
Thank you, Ms. Schwab. Right. Others in the audience wishing to testify? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Cheryl Fear, representing Education Minnesota. I just want to raise a couple of questions about Article 2, Section 10, and I somewhat agree with some of the comments that Representative Abler made regarding this. I do think that seems to be quite prescriptive. I also think that as we're looking at the language, it seems clear to me that we're expecting our secondary, probably middle school and secondary teachers that teach science particularly, to be reading specialists more or less, because there's a lot of prescriptive language that talks about, if you look at page 21, line 31, the program or collection of practices must include, at a minimum, in 5 areas of reading. And then it goes into detail there. I think, you know, they're teaching content, and I know that they test on content and reading comprehension, but this seems to get to maybe a higher level, and I think that it might call for some training programs and reading. I'm not sure. I'm raising the questions because that, to me, it just seems like a whole new definition of what we're expecting of our current teachers in science. And I think we need to talk more about this. And I don't have the answers. It just kind of raises a question in my mind as to what exactly do we mean, and what are the new expectations that we're putting on our teachers.
Thank you, Ms. Fear. Ms. Fear, I think you said science, but you meant reading, because we're talking about the reading section. Is that not correct?
Scientifically reading, though, right?
No, Ms. Fear, I think that means the program was developed using some proven standards, nothing to do with science, but that it followed a very specific development process. Right? That's usually what scientifically based means.
Maybe I'm just not reading it correctly.
Right. And the other thing, Ms. Fear, and I have Assistant Commissioner Nelson in front of us, I believe that the Assistant Commissioner already intimated that this is instruction for a science teacher program, development program, not what a science teacher would, or I'm sorry, not what a reading teacher would do in the classroom, but what a post-secondary institution would do in creating programs to license reading teachers. And Assistant Commissioner, am I correct in my interpretation?
Mr. Chair, you are absolutely correct. If it would assist, I could talk with my colleague here, because we have had communication quite extensively with the Board of Teaching, and the intent is to be more clear for higher ed programs in terms of their preparation and aligning it with established reading instruction descriptions and No Child Left Behind.
Thank you. And members, my Euphorian goal of having this bill passed by 10 o'clock doesn't seem that it will come to fruition. So there would be time for us to get some of these more technical questions answered, and then this bill will be brought back before the committee before it gets voted on. So this time
Mr.
to work
Chair,
through
I appreciate that.
You're welcome, Ms. Chair. All right. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Biskins. Commissioner Nelson. Commissioner Nelson. Woohoo. Commissioner, Assistant Commissioner Nelson. Representative Erickson has a question for you.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Biskins. Assistant Commissioner, I'd like to work with you to make the language beginning on page 21, beginning at line 25, I think a little bit more understandable to the public and to the group that has to understand what this says. So I would appreciate if we could work together on maybe just fixing it up a little bit so it's more understandable.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'd be happy to assist with that.
Thank you.
Thank you. On to Article 3. Mr. Sullivan.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Article 3 has three sections. Section 1 is a change brought to us by the Commissioner's Minnesota Non-Public Education Council. That's a 15-member advisory council to the Commissioner. They represent non-public schools throughout the state, including homeschools. The proposal, it really consists of two parts. Only one part is in this bill. The other part, which amends transportation laws, will be in the governor's education budget bill. The provision here, to get to the bottom line, is to amend special education law to add at least one parent of a non-public school student with a disability or a non-public school employee to the local special education advisory council. That is an advisory council that's in current law. It's described on pages 41 and 42 of the bill. And this would simply add one member of the non-public schools or a parent to that council to ensure services are provided effectively to kids in non-public schools. There are over 2,000 children in non-public schools that currently receive special education services in the state. So that's the change in this bill. The other change will be in the governor's budget bill. Section 2 is the State Interagency Coordinating Council. This is required by federal law, and it's described on pages 42 and 43 of the bill. The Interagency Coordinating Council, between 17 and 25 members, appointed by the government, by the governor. The change here would be to update the reporting responsibilities of that council and, frankly, to reduce some reporting burden by making two reports come on the same day. Both the recommendations that are now submitted by the council for the policies for a comprehensive and coordinated system to serve children with disabilities, as well as the so-called Part C annual performance report. Part C refers to a federal law. The reports would come on the same day and therefore reduce our reporting burdens, frankly. And also, a change here toward the end on page 43 would extend the council to 2009. Under current law, this council would expire June 30th, 2005. Section 3 of Article 3 would reinstate an advisory committee that was in law up to a couple of years ago. This is the Minnesota Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. The library itself, as you may know, is located in Faribault. The advisory committee has existed for some time, but in an advisory council bill a couple of years ago, for some reason or other, the bill didn't pass, and a number of advisory committees were eliminated, including this one. The commissioner is requesting, and they are, and the Library for the Blind is requesting that this advisory committee be put back in place. We don't require an appropriation for this because funds for that council come from a gift, a special gift from of the Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. Excuse me. That's the end of Article 3.
Then at this time, I'll ask if anyone in the audience would like to speak to Article 3. Ms. Schwab, welcome.
Mr. Chairman and members, Grace Schwab with the Minnesota School Boards Association. We have a concern on 41. Our concern with that council of adding that additional parent might be, what if there's not a non-public school in that district? An example I have is Alden School District in my former Senate district does not have a non-public school available in that district. Or what if there is a non-public school but no disabled children? Do we still have to add someone or keep people from other districts? We need some clarification about those kinds of circumstances.
Mr. Sullivan, would we be able to get that clarification when this bill is brought back before the committee?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. That was not the intent. I talked to the chair of the Non-Public Education Council earlier, who is here, as a matter of fact, Jim Field, and someone just pointed this out to us a little while ago, and I think we'd certainly be comfortable with an amendment to the effect that if a non-public school exists within the school district, then this would be required. Otherwise, it would not be required. We can work that language out.
Thank you. Thank you for pointing that out, Ms. Schwab. At this time, members, looking at the clock on the wall, we're going to stop at the end of this article. I'm going to lay the bill over for a future meeting, which will probably be on Tuesday. We'll bring it back up off the table. Right. Members, in your packet are the minutes from the previous meeting.
Mr. Chair, I move approval. I did study them for some time before the meeting began.
Representative Erickson moves that the minutes be approved. Are there any questions? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion does prevail. The committee is adjourned.